Paul Feig is the creator of Freaks and Geeks, and he joins DVD Talk today to talk about the DVD release for Freaks and Geeks. Paul, thanks for taking some time out today to talk to DVD Talk.
Oh, you bet. Thank you for thanks for doing it.
Definitely. So, it's here, the DVD.
Oh, you got it?
Yeah, I got it, and, you know, it exists. It must be the end of a very long road for you.
Yeah, they just sent me my box of 25 copies that I get, and it was, like, so exciting. I literally felt such a kind of a release when it showed up, because it's like after all these years of, you know, trying to get it out and thinking it wouldn't happen, and now it finally kind of puts the final period at the end of the Freaks and Geeks sentence, if you will.
When people pick up this DVD, they may not have an idea of just how much of a journey this series has had. Can you tell us a bit about how it all started and how it became?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it had a very charmed beginning of its life. It was, you know, something I wrote as a spec script when I was out driving around with my other, this movie I made called Life Sold Separately, and you know, so it didn't go through any development process that TV shows normally go through, where you go in and kind of pitch the idea, and then you write an outline, and they give their notes, and then you write a script, and they give their notes, you know, and it's kind of this long process where everybody puts their two cents in. This was completely like something that was written in hotel rooms when I was driving around the Midwest, came back, my friend Judd Apatow had a deal over at DreamWorks and had told me if, you know, I had something at any point that he thought would interest him, and that I should send it along. And when I finished it, it was like, I'd known him for years. I was like, oh, this is exactly our sense of humor. Sent it to him. Within 12 hours, he called me back and said, I want to sell it to DreamWorks. DreamWorks bought it, and then they took it into NBC in January, which is like basically when they're getting ready to greenlight shows, so it's definitely not the time they ever look at, you know, are looking for new scripts. But just so happened that when it showed up on their doorstep, they had been already, you know, developing like six, I don't know, a number of other high school scripts that they wanted to have the same feel that, you know, the Freaks and Geeks had, but I guess they weren't kind of happy with where those were. And so when this came in, they just went, this is exactly what we're looking for. So they greenlit it, and they said, we don't have any changes. Don't even touch the script, which we then, you know, Judd and I and Jake Kasdan got in there and really kind of tore it up after that, which they were like, why are you changing the script? Yeah. But and even I was kind of like, oh, what are we doing? But then, you know, it got like 1,000% better by doing that. And then we made it, and then people liked it, and suddenly we got on the schedule. You know, we got a Saturday night slot, so suddenly we were kind of like, ooh, should we celebrate or not? Because that's, you know, not necessarily a great spot for this kind of show. But, you know, we got on, and so we were charmed, and then sort of the charm started to fade because we had a really good premiere rating. Actually, we were sort of, you know, lauded as having a very strong premiere rating. And but then the next week it dropped off. And then we were off for 3 weeks because of the World Series, and then just all our problems started mounting as far as the ratings go. Because, you know, when you're off for 3 weeks and you come back, you got to rebuild the number. And then we were on for a few weeks, and they pulled us off for 2 months to change nights to put us on Monday night, to, you know, hoping that would be a better night. And then when we came on, we were up against Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, which was in its heyday of you know, being the biggest gun on television. So that completely killed us. And then we went up against a Marion Rota reunion, and that killed us because that was basically our same audience. And we were on the air and off. They kept pulling us on and off. And then finally they canceled us. But we did get 18 episodes made, only 15 or what was it, 12 of those aired before we got canceled. But, you know, right after we got canceled, we got nominated for a couple of Emmy Awards, one for, you know, for my writing on the pilot episode of the show, and then the other for casting. And we ended up winning the Emmy for casting, so we're now officially Emmy Award winning. And then we had these six other episodes that, you know, didn't air, but we finished them because we knew, you know, we would hopefully get them out there in syndication at that point. We weren't really... Nobody was really thinking about DVDs or videotape back then. So we were already kind of started thinking what we're going to do with them. Then the Museum of Television ran marathons of the six episodes, which, you know, tons of fans showed up for in New York and L.A. and then in Chicago. And then also NBC kind of started airing those other six at different places where they just had an opening in their schedule, and then one night they did a little marathon of the last three episodes on a, I forget what night it was. But so what happened from there was, you know, as I was, you know, got my stuff to submit for the Emmy Awards for the next year, I was looking at the rules, and it said, you know, you qualify as long as six original episodes air within a, you know, a certain period. And suddenly I kind of count on my fingers and go, well, you know, we actually aired another six episodes. So I just kind of, you know, just myself send in my little application saying, you know, putting the season finale that I wrote and directed up for an Emmy. And lo and behold, we got nominated a year and a half after we were, you know, canceled. So, which I think has to be some kind of record, I'd like to think. But then while all this was going on, you know, DVDs were starting to kind of grow and all that. We were in, you know, Judd and I were just thinking, God, we got to, you know, we really want to get this out there. And at the same time, it got picked up by ABC, what is it, Fox Family, I think, picked it up first, which was great because that was very exciting to have it airing. But then also our music rights, some of, you know, half of the music on the DVD, or on the show, I should say, we bought in perpetuity, which means, you know, we could use it forever. But the other half, because of money constraints, we were only able to buy for a couple of years. And so as these started airing in syndication, then we had to kind of lose half the music and just use what we called the international mix, which was we had our composer, Mike Andrews, do either sort of sound-alikes or just different pieces for where old songs were. And it was really good because he's great and he did some amazing stuff, but at the same time, you know, the music, those songs are as much a character in the show as the characters themselves. And I know myself, it was always like, oh, shoot, I wish that, you know, I missed that song, I missed that, you know, the other song. And then the fans, I know, definitely felt the same way. And then also these networks started kind of cutting things out of the show because they thought it was a little too rough for their, you know, their network or whatever. And so it just, you know, it started getting kind of watered down. And so we were thinking, God, we really, you know, it would be so great to get these out on DVD. And so that quest began. That was, you know, about it probably really started in earnest, I would bet, about a year after we were gone. And, you know, and Judd was making a lot of calls for different places, and places were kind of interested, but, you know, everybody would kind of stop when we said, you know, but we want all, you know, we need to clear all the original, all the other music and get it paid for. And they just, you know, that just sounded like way too much money to them. So everybody was like, well, maybe we'll possibly do it if you, you know, but only if you, you know, keep all this replacement music because we don't want to put a penny into it. And we just knew, you know, there's just no way we could ever possibly hold our heads up high by selling the show with half the music gone because, you know, as a fan, you would just, I would be really upset if I bought it and, like, it had, you know, half the music was out of there. So, you know, just said, well, you know, we just got to wait till someplace wants to do it. And, you know, a couple of years passed, and I have to admit, I completely gave up. I was just thinking, you know, there's no way because there's so much money and legal expenses and everything that are going to have to go into clearing these. So I just kept thinking, well, maybe at some point, you know, it'll get so at some point we'll be so far from having been on where people miss it enough that maybe somebody will, you know, decide they want to put the money in. But at the same time, Judd was always out kind of pounding the pavement for it. And when he was doing some appearance at the, I think it was at the Museum of Television, he showed a scene from Freaks and Geeks, and it just happened to be a guy named Richard Williams in the audience who works for a company called Shout Factory. And he saw it and was just thinking, gosh, oh my, you know, I forgot about this show and how great it was. I wonder if that's coming out on DVD, because he's been putting together DVDs of other shows for them. And talked to Judd and found out it wasn't. And Judd told him the whole thing about, you know, others, you know, we need the music cleared. And he went back to the guys who own Shout Factory, and everybody seemed to be into it. And so all of a sudden I get a call from Judd, hey, you know, somebody wants to do it. It's like, well, do they want the, you know, replacement music? He's like, no, they actually want to clear the real music. So, you know, I think neither one of us sort of dared to think it would actually happen, and then they just completely stayed on it, and next thing we knew, here we were getting these things out. And you know, it took them months and months to clear this music, and you know, a lot of money went into it. So I couldn't be more thrilled that they cared about the show enough. And then on top of it, you know, I remember some company at one point said we can put it out, but we can't really do any packaging, so it's going to have to be very, you know, low tech packaging. I was thinking, oh God, I don't want to look like, you know, you remember when a great show, but when they put out my so-called Life DVDs, the packaging was pretty awful, I think. So that was kind of like, oh shoot, I really want this to look good. But they were like, also, yes, we want to put great packaging into it. And on top of it, we're thinking, you know, we should do a special edition for the fans that has extra stuff. And, you know, I was like, well, you know, we should do a yearbook for that. And yeah, let's do a yearbook. So it was sort of this amazing thing that happened where suddenly we've got everything we wanted out of this. And I think the entire time always kind of like holding our breath, like, this isn't really going to happen, is it? And so that's why I say when 2 days ago my box of DVDs showed up at the doorstep looking fantastic in this packaging, it was just such a huge sigh of relief. I just feel like, you know, now I can relax because, you know, the baby is out there and its cheeks can be pinched by whoever wants to.
And does it have all of the original music?
Yeah, oh yeah, all the original music. It completely has all the original music. The only thing that fans who were at the 6-episode marathons will notice is missing is there was the end of one episode, Noshing and Moshing, we had put in a Neil Young song, Only Love Can Break Your Heart. That never aired. When it aired on television, it had the other song we picked out for, which I, you know, think is funny. It's different, and it was actually quite effective. But it's that Dean Martin song, I forget the name. Dean Martin song is it? I have to look in my book. But so that's in there. So I mean, that would be the only thing that if like fans who were at the museum, you know, look for that, they'll go like, oh shoot, I wish it was that. But that literally, you know, was the only thing that changed, and like I say, that had never aired really. So officially every single song is in this now, which is really cool. The Dean Martin was "No, You're Nobody Till Somebody Loves You" is the song. So yes, all the music is in, and the other great thing is you know, just because of DVD quality, it looks fantastic, and it's got 5.1 mixes on it, and you know, there's a ton of Easter eggs in there, and a lot of extra material of deleted scenes, also raw footage of scenes, and auditions of the cast, and blooper reels, and it just, I mean, it's really quite definitive, I have to say. We just said, let's not hold back anything, and especially in the special edition, has two extra DVDs worth of stuff that has a bunch of table reads that we did before we even started shooting the show of episodes, and also our appearance at the Paley Festival in California. With the entire cast, like over an hour's worth of interview, you know, of us in front of an audience being interviewed and answering questions, and then also just a ton more of deleted scenes and bloopers and raw footage and stuff. So it's a real, you know, we knew this had to be our legacy, and so we really put some major work into it. And on top of it, the special edition has this yearbook that's an 80-page yearbook that's really great because it's just filled with behind-the-scenes photos, but it's made to look like a yearbook from 1980. And it just really, it's fantastic. I'm very thrilled about it.
It's clear looking at both the special edition and the fan edition that there is so much behind-the-scenes footage and so many bloopers and so many deleted scenes. How did you go about sifting through all the material to pick the ones that you put on the discs?
Well, there was two things that happened. First was, as far as deleted scenes went, you know, Jed and I always knew there was like, you know, so many shows had stuff. You know, our shows always came in probably about 10 minutes too long just because of the way, you know, the nature of when you shoot something, it just kind of taffies. So we always knew, like, oh, shoot, that scene, you know, there's certain scenes that we were always like, God, I wish people could see these because we always thought they were so funny. And so we had videotapes of old cuts of the show that had those scenes on it. So we pulled all those together and went through that and just kind of wrote up a list of, like, let's put this scene on, let's put that scene on. So that's where a lot of those deleted scenes came from. But then the other side of it was we, you know, thought, God, there's, you know, there's got to be so many other things that are just in the dailies that happened that, you know, we can't remember a lot of them and remember different bloopers and just alternate takes and this and that. So basically what happened was we contacted some of our fans and said, who would like this job? And basically this girl who was one of our fans who was fantastic, named Tammy Lefko, said, I'll do it. And so this poor girl sat in a room with every dailies tape of every frame of footage we ever shot on Freaks and Geeks, and for 3 weeks watched and logged stuff, and basically went through and, you know, said, this is funny, this is a great, you know, thing because something funny happens at the end, or this is cool because this scene wasn't in there, and this is great because we didn't see this take of this, and made this monster list that then that we went through and, you know, basically picked out all the stuff that we thought was great. And so no stone had been left unturned on this.
So it sounds like the Freaks and Geeks DVD is fan-approved.
Yes, very much so. And then on top of it, Richard Williams, who, you know, is working through Shout Factory and basically kind of authored and did all the physical work putting these DVDs together and, you know, putting the menus together and all that, he's a huge fan of the show. And so he brought this real fan ethic to it that just kind of takes it so much to the next level because, you know, we've all bought tons of DVDs where you get them home and it just feels like the company just, you know, ran the tape through some whatever it is that puts it on DVD and threw a trailer on and put subtitles on it and then, you know, out it goes, and there's just no feeling of caring about it whatsoever. But this one just, I mean, it's so tailored to people who love the show. You know, every single menu has a great still frame that was pulled from the show, has one of Mike Andrews's original pieces from the show, unedited music pieces, and then also there's like a little bit of a funny bit of dialogue on each menu, either the beginning or it's at the end. You got to sit through, you know, wait for it to come up, and then like we said, there's Easter eggs in there that have lots of great alternate things or other music cues or photo galleries or funny record collection kind of things, and it's so kind of fan approved, even though, you know, the majority of the fans haven't seen it yet. I would be very surprised if people, you know, didn't feel that it was a very loving set of DVDs towards the show itself.
So it's my understanding that the folks who did the Lord of the Rings DVDs were the same ones in terms of the transfer that did Freaks and Geeks. And I think it shows. It's a really brilliant transfer.
Oh, yeah, that's true. It was Laser Pacific, and Richard was, you know, got a lot of people to do us a lot of favors and put in a lot of hours because they, you know, they were all loved the show. And, excuse me, a lot of people were also, they were discovering the show for the first time as they were working on it and were kind of, you know, Richard would tell me, God, you know, the people who hadn't seen it, they're like suddenly addicted to the show. So, yeah, it was really like, I don't think anybody's hands touched it that didn't either love the show or end up loving the show. So, you know, I always knew, you know, we had to get these out, and so did Judd, because we would just get deluged. Like, every day we would get emails from people saying, when's the DVD coming out? When's this coming out on video? When's this coming out on DVD? I mean, it's went up for, you know, literally since the day we were canceled, people started asking about it. And, you know, the tapes have been being sold on eBay forever. But the great thing was, you know, we had two other of our fans, Eric Williams and Jeff Black, came on to do all of our menu graphics, designing these different, you know, there's like lockers that have different things from each show on it and stuff, and they did other kind of graphics for it too. And Eric was saying, you know, the greatest thing for him was when he, you know, got a DVD to watch, that, like, he was so used to watching these episodes on VHS tapes with the quality was so bad. He's like, my God, it's the first time I've ever seen certain things in the background and been able to read certain things on flyers or insert shots or see people's expressions you know, because it was always so low tech before. So that's what's cool too, and it is kind of amazing when you put it on because it's just, you know, it looks so fantastic.
Watching Freaks and Geeks, you can't help but be struck by all the music. You know, you had Billy Joel, you had Cream, you had The Who, you had The Grateful Dead. And these songs aren't just playing, but often an integral part of the episode.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that was what was so exciting about it. It really goes back to just, you know, the way we faced the show from day one, which was we knew, you know, we wanted to have a lot of music in there. But it also, we just didn't want to do sort of where you just, you know, you finish an episode, then you go, okay, let's kind of, you know, jam a bunch of songs in and just lay a bunch of songs on top. Because we actually, going into the pilot, kind of, you know, we had written, the pilot was written around various songs, but then it was like, yeah, but then we'll pad out the rest of it by just dropping in songs like, you know, Scorsese did in Goodfellas and kind of just have this wall-to-wall thing. But we quickly found out it just didn't work because where the songs were supposed to be, they were so important to the show and to the story that just laying other songs in just diluted their power. And so from that point on, we were just writing songs specifically into the show. You know, I would sit there on many occasions, like with a scene that I was trying to figure out, and put on a song that I knew I kind of wanted to get into an episode, and literally write the scene to the song as it was on, and just play it over and over until I'd finish the scene. And I just think that makes these so much more vital and makes them illustrate the story. And that's why it was so hard to just pull those songs out and put replacement music over them, because they were forwarding the story as much as anything, you know, as much as the scripts were. And so the other thing was when we were doing it, we also back then were very smart about going, look, as much as, you know, my goal was to get, you know, Led Zeppelin into the show, but, you know, you had to be realistic and just say, look, there's no way we could ever afford to do a Led Zeppelin song. Plus, they hardly ever let people use them anyway. In the one episode, the I'm with the Band, where they keep playing Cream, Sunshine of Your Love, originally it was supposed to be AC/DC's Back in Black, but when we checked, even just to have the band play Back in Black and not use the original recording was insanely high. So we did a lot of weeding that way by saying, you know, okay, we can't get Beatles, we can't get Stones, we can't get that. But what was great was, you know, we were fans of so much other music. You know, I was a huge Ted Nugent fan, and, you know, and Cheap Trick and Van Halen. And they, you know, especially like those bands were really, once we kind of went to them and said, hey, can we use some of your music, they were so into it that suddenly they were, you know, kind of almost like saying, here, you know, you please use more, which is great, because here we got these super bands from back then, and we have their permission, so we were able to pull it off. But then, you know, there's other ones that were tough, the real nail-biters, like, you know, the Grateful Dead, which, you know, an episode was written by him. I wrote an episode completely around Grateful Dead music, going like, well, okay, if we can't get it, then we're screwed, because you can't do a sound-alike of the Grateful Dead. But, you know, we were able to get all that, and then, you know, and also able then to put in, you know, stuff, you know, that we just loved that we hadn't heard on TV, like XTC and old Joe Jackson, and, you know, and I think we got Black Flag in there and stuff. And, you know, that was really thrilling to, you know, because we all have our favorite songs that some are popular and some people haven't heard. And so it was as fun to get that in there, you know, to get, you know, put Steve Martin's King Tut into an episode, which was such a big part of Judd and I's past. You know, so at the end of the day, you kind of also, you know, a lot of times it's very selfish, and it just happens to, you just hope it entertains other people because you just want to get stuff in that you love. So we had all that, and then it literally just came down to, I mean, I don't even know the full process that Shout Factory went through. All I know is that it literally took them months and months of, and Judd knows the name of the guy, I unfortunately don't know, but there was one guy in the legal department in particular who was really just making all these calls and heading all this stuff up, and, you know, it took forever, because that's a thankless job, because not only did those bands, you know, those bands kind of let us use it, but now with time had gone by, you kind of had to renegotiate everything for the DVD. So, you know, who knows if somebody saw the episode, didn't like it, or didn't like the way we used their music, you know, so it was a nail-biter the whole time, but they pulled it off. I still don't know how they did it, but I'm glad they did. And also, it speaks nicely to the show that people, had music in it, thought it was a good enough show to remain involved, let their creativity, their creative product remain in the show. So it was a nice little stamp of approval.
So with Mike White, who worked with you on Freaks and Geeks, going off and doing School of Rock, did you feel like there was some sort of connection there, some sort of homage?
I like to think it was. Because we always had Mr. Rosso, the guidance counselor, who was an old hippie and who even had a rock band that would play, Alice Cooper, who would get his guitar out and sing Alice Cooper's 18 to the kids to try to adjust their attitudes and stuff. So, I don't know, but how much he was, how much of an influence we were, but everybody who worked on the show was completely surrounded by that era's music. It's like when we had the actors first come in, they're all so young, and I got some of them going, I'm talking about Led Zeppelin's Cashmere, and they're like, oh, what's that? I've never heard that. It's like, oh my god, A, you're all making me feel really old, and then B, it was like, okay, here, we're going to get you a CD collection, and so we completely turned them on to this music, and I know even now they're still into it, so that's nice. Anybody can turn on the Led Zeppelin, it's always a goal of mine.
That almost harkens back to the finale episode where the woman's saying, if I could go back and listen to the Dead for the first time, I would.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm really happy with how that episode came out, because we were, it's always nerve-wracking when you're doing something like that. It could come out corny, and plus, it's such a band with such a following, you don't want to kind of make it out to be cartoony or something. But I'm pleased with that. It was good. The other thing was, I was never a huge Grateful Dead fan, and so when I started writing that episode, I got a lot of their albums and was hearing some of them for the first time, and so it was fun. I was able to kind of bring this like fresh fanaticism with the discovery that Lindsay had, and so I think that kind of helped that episode out too.
On Freaks and Geeks, you covered some pretty stark issues between teen drugs and sex and religion. How were you able to get that up on the network TV? Those are the kind of topics that people more associate with cable than with network.
It's odd. The pot episode was an interesting thing because, we knew we wanted to do something about what would happen to, an A student smoking pot for the first time. But, you're always dealing with the censors and standards and practices at a network. So Judd was really smart. He called up the censor and said, we want to do a show about, somebody smoking pot for the first time. What can we do and what can't we do? And what was so funny is some of the stuff they said we could do was stuff we thought for sure we couldn't do. So I was like, oh, okay. So it really helped us know the parameters of what we could do with that particular episode. And so, we did it. And unfortunately, that we still don't know how that episode affected us, because we got canceled right after that episode aired. And Judd is certain that the president of GE or whatever had just had me flipping by and saw Lindsay smoking pot and went, okay, cancel that show. So, and as far as the religion thing, that was something that was always really important to me, to be part of Lindsay's character, is that here's a girl who is having a complete crisis in her life and in the pilot because of the death of her grandmother, and she wasn't the only one in the room with her when she died. And the grandmother right before she dies said she doesn't see anything. I really wanted to get that across, that that somebody would, how your life could be changed if you were suddenly questioning everything you thought you believed in before that. I there's times I wanted to hit that theme a little harder throughout the show, but it just hit it enough so that it kind of hung over Lindsay's character without being there so strong that it might put certain people off, but at the same time, to address it in the way that a kid does. I mean, that's what's so great about doing a show like this one and doing stuff for teens, is you can get away with a lot more, because when you're a teen, you really are questioning everything. And so it's just a natural thing to see a teenager, and especially a smart teenage girl like Lindsay, you know, having a crisis or calling this stuff into question. And so the networks, you know, we were dealing with them. They didn't mind it at all. It was funny when we were doing the Halloween episode, when I wrote that, I had a speech. There was a speech in there where Franco was talking about you know, the hypocrisy of the neighborhood because everybody believes in God and stuff, but then Halloween comes and they'll put up pictures of ghosts and devils and all that kind of thing. And then in one draft that had gotten cut out, and one of our executives over at NBC called up and she was like, "Oh, put that back in. We love that run." So I was like, oh, "Okay, cool." So you know, you do what you want to, and then you hope that it can come across. But your responsibility as an artist is to do it in such a way that it's not exploitative or it's not easy. You know, I mean, how many times, you know, you can see that stuff done badly and it just turns everybody off because the people whose beliefs it go against, you know, just go, "Ugh, that's, you know, whatever kind of tripe." And the people whose beliefs it support go like, "Oh, God, you're not helping our case because you're making it look so, you know, bad," or whatever. So, you know, it becomes a mix of kind of a personal responsibility as somebody who's putting stuff out to the public and, you know, and trying to walk that line of just, you know, getting your point across.
Mm-hmm. So the internet played a pretty critical role, both when your series was airing and, you know, in the period between airing and petition for the DVD. How did that all come about in terms of connecting the show to the internet? And in terms of the petition, do you think, you know, how effective was that in terms of getting the DVD released?
Well, the petition was hugely instrumental in that because, you know, all we'd been able to do is tell all these companies in the past that, you know, look, these fans, you know, we have a lot of fans and they're writing us all the time and they really want these DVDs, but, you know, at the end of the day, how do you really prove that? I mean, we weren't prescient enough to start printing up all the emails that we got so that we could do, you know, like a Mr. Smith Goes to Washington and drop stacks of, you know, emails on people's desks. But, you know, so we knew we had to prove to them that there was going to be a market for it, that they could look and say, look, here's at least, you know, this many guaranteed sales, so you're going to make X amount of dollars. You're not going to lose your investment on this. And so so it was really important, you know, and just, you know, so then we got people to sign this petition saying, look, you don't have to commit to buying this. It's just if you think you would buy this DVD, sign this petition. And if you have any friends who you think who think they would, have them sign it. You know, so very quickly we got up to like 39,000, over 39,000 people on this petition. You know, and that's really what a company wants to see because, you know, it's funny. This is sort of the thing that I've discovered about the internet, and I think other people are, and I think it's also one of the things that kind of ended the dot-com boom is that the internet is so kind of in your face when you're in it, you know. So, like, let's say we've got a message board and our show's on and we've got, like, you know, 400 or 500 people are posting on this board. Let's even do it less than that. Let's say like 200. You have like 100, 200 regular posters that are coming on and just, you know, writing all this stuff and interacting. That feels gigantic when you're in it because, especially when you're doing a TV show, you're so insulated with the, you know, you're with the crew and you're with the writers and you're with the producers and then you've got the network. And that's, you know, and that's your only sounding block. So you never kind of get to experience what's going on as far as how many people are watching it. You get ratings numbers, but, you know, what does that mean? That's just a number, and you kind of can translate it, but there's no kind of physical proof. You're not flying over cities and peering into people's houses and saying, oh, look, they're looking, oh, they're watching. So you do become sort of, like, desperate to get some sort of feedback. And so then when you got this website and all these people are showing up, it feels huge. So then you start going, my God, look at all the fans. But, you know, the other side of that, then you go, okay, well, let's say there's 500 people that are posting regularly. You know, it's 500 people. For network television, that's nothing. You know, that doesn't even exist. That means nothing. You know, and for people in selling DVDs, selling books, selling anything, that's a low, you know, that's a very low number. But you start to kind of feel, it's easy to start to feel like, the whole world's kind of revolving around the thing you're doing, because you go, look at all these people we're interacting with. So that's why, you know, it was important, you know, because then a company can throw that at you, you know, and go like, well, how many people are in, you know, are you interacting with? Well, 500 people. Okay, well, that, you know, that's no sales for us. So that's why we had to step out and get like a real number for people. And that's why it was so surprising for us, because, you know, there was a moment where we put it up, you know, Judd and I going like, okay, well, we've said for years that there's so many people that want these. You know, what if we put it up and only 500 people sign up on the thing? Then, you know, then that's not going to get anybody to put it out. But so that's why it was so fantastic when suddenly this number was just jumping and jumping and jumping. Then you go, okay, that's great. And, the great thing for me, the thing I really feel is that, you know, that's just the number of people who know about our website, who know people who go to the website and who are hardcore fans of the show. What I'm hoping will happen, what I'm feeling very optimistic will happen is, you know, over the past number of years, people have either heard from people they know that about Freaks and Geeks, or they've read, you know, because we're still getting referenced in articles all the time about, you know, good TV shows and all that. So I think enough people have seen the name Freaks and Geeks that I'm convinced we're going to have, you know, a number of sales will be people just walking into DVD stores or wherever, or looking on the internet at the DVD sites and going like, oh, Freaks and Geeks, God, that, you know, I've heard so much about that show. You know, well, why don't, you know, maybe I'll pick it up. And you know, because my hope is that we're going to get a whole new kind of group of people who like the show and who, you know, become fans of it. And that's what's great about DVD is now it can be out there and, you know, it can be passed around and people can, you know, loan it. You know, you hope they buy it, but you also, you know, I'd love it if people just loaned it to their friends and, you know, got to see it and then liked it so much they'd want their own copy. And, you know, and then the little show can just kind of have a second wind, even though it's not coming back. It's just, you know, you do so much work on something, you really want as many people as possible to see it. That's the whole goal of doing this kind of thing.
Freaks and Geeks really, in a lot of ways, is timeless. I mean, even though it's set, you know, in a very specific time period, people discovering it on DVD today probably wouldn't distinguish it from something else that could be on television right now.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I mean, I'm proud of, too, is it does have kind of a... timeless is probably too highfalutin of a description for it, but it definitely isn't anchored. It isn't anchored anywhere, just in the sense, even though it is anchored in 1980, it's still, the themes are so kind of universal that I think by taking it out of modern day, it opens it up for adults, because they go, oh, God, that's like it was when I was back then. And then it opens up for kids, because they can go, well, I wasn't around back then, but I'm going through those exact same problems that those kids are. And so I think it makes it more effective than doing, you know, that was always the fear when we were going to try to sell it to a network, was that we were just absolutely predicting that they were going to say, we want to do it, but you have to make it modern day. And to me, that would just made it so much less interesting, because, you know, I didn't want to deal with cell phones. I didn't want to deal with the post, you know, AIDS trauma of sex and dating. I wanted to deal with what it was like just to be afraid of sex because you're afraid of sex, not because you're afraid of, you know, of contracting something fatal. And so it was able to keep, innocence isn't the right word, because, you know, I hate when people go, oh, it was so much, you know, more innocent back then than it was now. It's like, no, it felt just as, you know, deadly back then as it does now. It's just, you know, things, you know, new situations come in, but I really wanted to just show that, you know, look, these problems are universal. If 1,000 years ago, I bet people in their teens were, you know, even though their lives were a lot different, they were experiencing the same emotions as far as insecurity and fear and you know, trying to kind of not get tormented by their peers and all that kind of thing. So I hope that it remains kind of vital to people in that way.
So outside of Freaks and Geeks, what's going on with you? I mean, obviously, Life Sold Separately exists. I've heard that it might come to DVD. We've heard really good buzz on your feature, I Am David. When's that coming out?
Yeah, it's coming out in October. It's going to be released in about 500 theaters by Lionsgate. And we're actually the UN, the United Nations High Council of for Refugees, has come on as a sponsor of the film because it deals with a kid escaping, you know, it basically deals with a refugee kid in post-World War II Europe. And so that was really nice to kind of get that vote of confidence from them. And we've been doing screenings for different, you know, teachers' organizations and all this, trying to do kind of educational outreach. And the response has just been overwhelmingly huge to it. I mean, you know, it's very different from Freaks and Geeks. And then in other ways, it's not, only because, it, you know, it's a story of an outsider. It's really about somebody kind of, you know, discovering the world for the first time and learning how to kind of, you know, negotiate their way through it and find their own place in the world, even though, you know, there's people against them and stuff. So, yeah, it's a theme I love, which is just, you know, this theme of the outsider, because I think we all ultimately feel like that at the end of the day.
So what else are you working on, and what else is next for you?
I just directed a couple episodes of Arrested Development, which was a lot of fun. I did the season finale for that show. And I'm writing my second book, follow-up to my first book, Kick Me. Got that going. And been developing a show for HBO. And I developed another show for NBC that didn't end up going. But it was a sci-fi comedy. I personally loved it. But that was a tough one to try to get them to do. But, yeah, so I've got this HBO one that I'm still developing with them, which is called Nice Guys, and it's basically a show about kind of geeky guys in their 20s trying to date, you know, trying to navigate their way through the dating world. But you know, just like what I did with Freaks and Geeks and, you know, trying to make it kind of what people really go through, that's what I'm doing with trying to do with this one, too. So we'll see. I mean, you know, it's always a long shot with HBO because they develop so many shows, but it's been fun so far.
Any plans to reunite with Judd and maybe Jake Kasdan and the other people that were the core of Freaks and Geeks to do another project?
Yeah, sure. I mean, definitely. It's, you know, we're all kind of off doing our separate things. Judd's doing movies right now, and I've, you know, got my things I'm doing. But, yeah, I mean, we definitely love each other and love working together, and we're a good team. So, yeah, it's anything is possible. We rule nothing out because, you know, at the end of the day, all we want to do is try to get more good stuff made. And so we will do whatever it takes to get that done. If people will let us do it, that's a whole other thing.
Well, at least congratulations on getting this show out on DVD. As we talked about, you know, at the top of the interview, I mean, it was no small task.
I still literally have to pinch myself. I mean, I've been ridiculous. Like, I literally kind of like carry the DVD around with me from room to room wherever I'm working, just so I can have it there and go like, oh, okay, you know, it feels like it doesn't exist still. So to me, the thrilling thing will be to walk into a store and see it there. You know, it'll be less thrilling if I walk in and see it in the discount bin. But I'm hoping that we will. I feel very confident that we will sell pretty well. I mean, we're already doing well on some of the internet sites, I know.
Well, I hope it exceeds your expectations. I'm sure it will. It's a pretty amazing show.
Oh, thanks, man. I appreciate that.
Paul Feig, thanks again.